ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Matt Brand. Welcome to the Country Hour. Today I'll take you on a trip to the hills north of Pine Creek, where exploration companies are lining up to try and strike gold.
I think if the gold price holds up, which I expect it to, I think we could quite easily see four or five new mines open up within 250 kilometres of Darwin here along the Stuart Highway.
And I'll be speaking to the Northern Territory's Mining Minister, Gerard Maley, at about 10 past one. So if you've got a question that you would like to put to the Minister, send it through on the text line this afternoon, which is 0487 99 1057. Minister Gerard Maley joining the program at about 10 past one. He's the Minister for Mining, Energy, Fisheries, Agriculture. So plenty to talk about this afternoon with him, and he's happy to take your questions. So send them through on 0487 99 1057. The Northern Territory Government is working towards phasing out gill nets in the commercial barramundi fishery by the end of next year's season. And today the government says it has formed a Barramundi Fishery Adjustment Committee made up of independent experts who will oversee compensation and the buyout of commercial barramundi licences. Daniel Capps is the Chief Executive of the NT Seafood Council. He is not on this committee. Dan, what do you make of the government's announcement today and the forming of this new committee?
Well, we certainly welcome it. It's something that the Seafood Council have been advocating for since the beginning of this process and since the current government came to power with their commitment to phase out gill nets. Traditionally, these kind of decisions would be informed through a process of advisory committees, which would have various sectors included in those discussions. We felt it inappropriate that the commitment sought by some of the sectors that would be sitting inside those advisory committees had advocated for the phase out of gill nets. And we felt that it was inappropriate for them to then be involved in the discussions around what the compensation should be for people that have effectively been put out of business as a consequence of this government commitment.
Right. So who will be on this committee then to decide the compensation?
So the committee, as I understand, has been set up with a number of economists, some lawyers, and I believe fisheries management experts. And the individuals involved have been involved in these type of buyback compensation schemes across a number of fisheries through various jurisdictions across Australia. And this brings a certain level of security and confidence that they understand the structures and the implications of what needs to be considered, but more so that they don't have any ties to the Northern Territory and don't really carry that political baggage, as it were, of those that would
understood.
Normally be
so it's really going to be a committee of independent experts in their field. It's not like this committee is going to have AFANT on it or the NT Seafood Council involved in it. It's really people coming in.
Absolutely, Matt. Yeah, absolutely. And therein lies the strength, I believe.
So for those who are still using gill nets, they're about to come to the end of this season in the next month or so. How's the next 12 months shaping up for them? Do you think we'll see much fishing next year?
I think the guys that are out fishing at the moment principally have leased those licenses off of some of the other license holders who are no longer in a position to fish at scale and who have effectively wrapped up their operations here in Darwin. And the guys that are out fishing have thought, well, we have a window of opportunity here. They're able to catch wild caught barramundi and Entis redfin, and effectively they're making their revenue or their profit margins based on the shrinking supply and the increasing demand of wild caught barramundi in the market. So effectively, when they've looked at this, they've thought, right, we've got 3 to 4 years, and we'll operate within that timescale. And you know, everybody is well aware that, you know, September next year is effectively D-Day, and from that day on, there will no longer be any supply of wild-caught barramundi or Entis redfin into the territory market.
And that will actually be the end of Entis redfin, full stop, really. Like, there'll still be farmed barramundi. I know that's not wild-caught, but there will be barramundi for people to buy, but threadfin will proper go missing off the menu, I would have thought.
That's absolutely correct, yes. From September next year, certainly you'll see the stocks decline in the shops, not the fishing stocks. Ultimately, what will happen through this process is that we are hoping to then sit down with government and look at how a future commercial fishery within that barramundi fishery can be restructured to ensure that we actually have wild-caught barramundi and Entis redfin back on the menu sooner rather than later. Certainly the feedback that we have from the public when we talk to them about gill nets, and they realise that there'll be no wild-caught barramundi or redfin on the menu, they're going, well, where are we going to get it from? And my answer is simply, well, you're not, until we are able to develop a new fishery within that, that particular fishery.
The government says the Department of Fisheries is progressing alternative gear trials. Have you received any updates on this?
I'm aware of alternative gear trials that are taking place in Queensland. I'm also aware that there are efforts to bring that project and expand it to the Northern Territory environment. And that really is the last I've heard of it, is that there were endeavours to do that. But certainly I'm not aware of any on-ground trials that are currently taking place in the Northern Territory.
And just finally, maybe back to this newly formed committee and its job of rolling out, I guess, the buyback process of these fishing licences. Have you heard any rough figures on what a fishing licence might be worth?
It's a little bit more complex than just the value of the license. So we've had some communications with the committee, and we, as the council, have put in our submission as to what we believe that compensation methodology should look like. The license holders have also been invited to make submissions to the committee as well. And effectively what we're saying is that there's a market value for a license, and our argument is that that market value has to be considered before any commitments were made politically, because that obviously has an impact on that license value. There's the buying back of the actual assets, for example, as well as compensation for the loss of assets. So if you've got boats and you've got nets and you've got sheds for processing.
If you build a processing plant out near the port, does that count?
Well, potentially, yes. It's something that was bought for the purposes of processing barramundi from that particular fishery. That is certainly something that ought to be brought into the consideration as well. Plus, the future profits that you base your investment decisions on future forecasts, that forecast is no longer viable. And so there has to be a compensation for that loss of profits moving forward. And lastly, a solatium payment. It's a payment that compensates people for being forced to sell their rights and their assets through no fault of their own. So that's a well-established methodology that's used throughout many jurisdictions. And that has been the basis for our submission to this particular group.
Well, thank you so much for your time this afternoon, Dan. Really appreciate it. And it's kind of hard to believe there's only, what, 9.5 months left of fishing, commercial fishing using gill nets in the Northern Territory.
It's come around very quickly. And I think the penny is starting to drop with the public that, wow, there's actually going to be no World Cup Barramundian threadfin on the menu after September next year. And it's something that the government really need to address as a matter of urgency, I would suggest.
Thanks for your time.
No worries, Matt. As a pleasure.
This is Daniel Capps, who's the Chief Executive of the NT Seafood Council. The Fisheries Minister, Jerome Maley, will be joining me at about 1:10 this afternoon, so I'll ask him about this. And if you've got questions that you'd like to put to the Minister, send them through now on 0487 99 1057.
Hi, I'm Verity. I'm a licensed aircraft engineer here in the Territory, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
And for cricket fans, I can tell you, play has resumed there at Morara Stadium, and the Aussies are in trouble. Gee, they're in trouble. It's 4 for 76. After a pretty decent start by Jake Weatherall and Travis Head, it's just all fallen apart there on day one of this wonderful first test being held in Darwin. So hopefully the second session is a bit kinder to the Aussies. But they're battling away there at Morara. It's 4 for 76. What we might do is have a quick song by the Wilson Pickers, and then I'll take you to the hills north of Pine Creek to meet one of the many exploration companies lining up to try and strike gold.
Florals for spring? Never out of fashion. Organic Gardener magazine has your garden bursting with colour, abuzz with good bugs, and brimming with wicking beds and bunches of bananas at newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
Another resources company has joined the hunt for gold in the hills north of Pine Creek. Far Northern Resources estimates there's about 120,000 ounces of gold at the historic Bridge Creek mine. And at today's current price, that gold would be worth about $750 million, which sounds pretty good. Company director Cameron Woodrow took Sam Parry on site to show him the drilling program that's now underway.
We're just sitting on top of the Howley Anticline. We're about 30 to 40 kilometres south of Adelaide River. This is the sort of culmination of probably almost 30 years of exploration on and off at Bridge Creek. This project was picked up by Far Northern Resources almost 4 years ago. It had a lot of historical drilling. We then put a program together to basically fact check a lot of that historical drilling and to also try and improve on the historical drilling. This last little bit, which is only 750 metres of drilling, is actually diamond drilling, and it will take a true representation of the expression or the ore that we can then use for both metallurgical testing and geotechnical testing, which is one of the final sort of pieces of the puzzle that we need to be able to potentially make a decision on whether or not this is a viable mine.
So you're basically extracting core samples using this rig here. We're watching three guys. They've just started up a bit of equipment on the back of a flatbed truck. It's got a huge boom that's on a 45 degree angle or so. That's what's getting this core sample out today?
You're right. That's exactly right. It's 60 degrees. This hole will go to about 75 metres. So what it's trying to do is capture in situ the core that we're looking to test.
What's the kind of gold that you're looking for? Because it's not alluvial then, is it?
It's the gold that's in the hard rock. That's essentially what it is. And most of what the majors up and down between here and Pine Creek are all looking at the hard rock deposits in the area. And it's not new. There's been hard rock mines in this area for decades. It's just a combination of a gold price
when this was originally discovered or originally drilled in the 1980s at $300 to $500 an ounce is now circa $6,000 an ounce. So the economics have changed. So the area is now starting to hot up, and a lot of these larger companies are starting to plough resources back into the area because they know how rich it is.
So the drilling that's happening here today, describe where that is in the kind of life cycle of your project. What are you hoping to achieve here?
Well, I think from discovery to production, you're probably looking at 10 to 12 years. I mean, we've obviously had a little bit of a leg up because there was a discovery here. We weren't the ones that made the discovery. I mean, we're obviously trying to expand on the discovery. I think the biggest thing ahead of us now is probably new mining agreements and licensing with the Northern Territory Mines Department. If we can do that in conjunction with the metallurgy and the geotechnic work that needs to be done, and we're successful in our predictions of what's here and how that's going to come out and how the modelling is going to work, then we could potentially have something here in the next 2 years. I think that'd be an almost realistic time.
How many people might be here when you dig a pit, if that is what happens?
Depending on what direction we go in regards to processing on-site, off-site, it'll probably get up around 20, and then probably half that when we start to get into actual production. Could swell again if we decide that we're actually going to build our own processing facility on-site. We're just trying to dot I's and cross T's and get through our body of work. We're trying to prove up the historical work that's been completed, and we're trying to add to it. You know, we're probably one of the smaller people in this neck of the woods. I'm in constant contact with guys from other mine sites around here, and you know, everybody's trying to accomplish the same thing. Everybody shares ideas and data and tools and local knowledge, drillers. It's a good community.
You're clearly optimistic about the potential of this site. And clearly others are in this region as well. What do you think the future holds for gold exploration or extraction in this region?
I think it's been forgotten for a long time. Certainly it's the gold price that has sparked the recent works around the Pine Creek, Howley area here south of Darwin. I think if the gold price holds up, which I expect it to, I think we could quite easily see 4 or 5 new mines open up within 250 kilometres of Darwin here along the Stuart Highway.
That's Cameron Woodrow, who's a director of the ASX-listed Far Northern Resources. He was speaking to Sam Parry. As we go to air this afternoon, the Aussie gold price is sitting at $6,256 per ounce, which is up 20% on this time last year. Not bad. Not bad at all. Now, on the topic of gold, if you missed the Country Hour yesterday, then you missed our coverage of the Mount Bundy Gold Project coming back to life. The owners of Hanking Gold and Primary Gold are investing $500 million to build a new gold processing plant and restart the Mount Bundy project, which has been mothballed since the 1990s. The company held a construction commencement ceremony yesterday out on site. The Country Hour was there and spoke to Hanking's Chief Development Officer, John Zimmerman, who says the whole region will benefit from this project.
Oh, look, it's going to be huge. In construction, we'll have well over 300 construction-related jobs in many trades, administration to cleaning, and then into production. We'll have probably 250 to 300 full-time jobs, and that's just at the initial phase. Once we get Tom's Gully up and going, there'll be further recruitment and employment required, and then you'll have the flow-on effect from local contractors and other service providers we need to help the project keep moving along.
And we also spoke to Peter Shepherd from the local Corroboree Park Tavern. He says he's already seen local businesses benefiting from the construction work that's happening out at Mount Bundy.
Look, it'll definitely provide employment. I think the property values might go up a bit more, so that's good for even people that are not directly involved with the mine at all, but still maybe pick up a bit of a bonus there. And they've been been very good with all the local people for jobs and local contractors. I reckon I went past 4 local contractors I knew that were working on site as we were going around the tour. So local station owner there, Tony Harrow, just put in a 50-cube pad for their accommodation. They're putting a 200 or 300-man camp in there. So Tony's been busy doing all that. So I went out and had a look with the GAs when he was doing all that. And, yeah, they seem pretty committed to the territory.
Peter from the Corroboree Park Tavern having a chat to us yesterday about the Mount Bundy Gold Project. If you missed that coverage, it'll be up on our podcast. And there's an article up online right now too, if you go searching for ABC Rural.
Yeah, my name's Spud Smith. I'm originally from Mungindoi, but I live in Umpty-Doo and I love the country here and keep it up. Love it.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. A reminder, if you need to duck out into the paddock, you can always download our podcast and listen at a time that suits you. I hope you can stick around, though, because in a moment I'll be speaking to the Northern Territory's Minister for Fisheries and Agriculture and Mining and Energy, Gerard Maley. If you've got a question for the Minister, send it through on 0487 99 1057. Cricket fans, I can tell you, Australia is now 4 for 90 there at Morara Stadium in Darwin. So this is day one of the first test between Australia and Bangladesh. The Aussies got off to a pretty good start. Travis Head and Jake Weatherall were doing just fine, but then the wheels came off. Alex Carey and Steve Smith currently at the crease trying to steady the ship. Australia are 4 for 90. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Hannah Whiteside's there this afternoon. Hannah, what's making news in the weather?
At the moment, we've got, about the territory, some windy conditions in central districts. That's eased off a little bit since this morning, so we're gusting around 56 kilometres an hour in Barkly earlier today. And that southeasterly surge is making its way up further north as well. So we do have a strong wind warning for the Roper Groote Coast today, just with the southeasterlies picking up speed there. Otherwise, a little bit of cloud cover over northern parts of the territory, just some patchy cloud cover there, and humidity's still a little bit up about the north. And, the south is looking pretty clear today. There's going to be some rainfall about southern districts from late tomorrow into Saturday, though, so that's the next thing to look out for down south.
And that's a pretty decent Barkly breeze today. Is today the peak of the winds?
Today's probably the peak through central districts. It's still going to be quite windy, especially during the mornings, with it's pretty strong ridge that we've got through southern parts of Australia at the moment, so it is helping to strengthen those winds. But yes, today is the peak for this week in the central district.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the opportunity maybe for a little bit of rain in the coming days in the centre. How many millimetres potentially are associated in that system?
Yeah, so it'll start to move over the southwest late tomorrow, and then more so on Saturday is when we're looking at the main rainfall out of that system. So we can kind of expect anywhere up to around 10 millimetres in the Lassiter district during Saturday, potentially some pockets of higher, maybe up to 15 millimetres. That will be more isolated in nature for those any higher totals. And then as that system kind of moves into the Simpson district during Saturday, more so in the afternoon, could expect more like 2 to 5 millimetres in those parts in the southeast there.
And I don't suppose you've got a detailed forecast for Morara Stadium, do you?
Moorah Stadium with the cricket. So it's going to continue to be relatively humid with some cloud cover for the rest of today, patchy cloud for the rest of today. Tomorrow looks more like clear skies, so sunnier conditions during Friday and for most of Saturday as well. Winds are relatively light, sort of east to southeasterly winds during the daytime. That's kind of the state of play around Moorah.
Hannah, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
All right, thanks, Matt.
Hannah Whiteside there at the Weather Bureau.
Landline explores the National Soil Archive, where the oldest sample just turned 100.
Yeah, we did celebrate. Yeah.
Did you?
We had a little team party.
Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
It is 10 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. My guest this afternoon is Gerard Maley, the Territory's Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries, Mining and Energy. Afternoon to you, Minister.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to your listeners.
Are you at the cricket?
I was at the cricket this morning for an hour or so, but I'm back in the office doing some work, catching up on the feared paperwork, Matt, to be honest with you. It never ends.
So were you there when the going was good, or were you there to watch the collapse?
When I was there, the going was good. I left there about half an hour. I think there were three downs. I haven't actually known. What's the score at the moment?
It is 4 for 97.
Okay, well, I saw a couple get out, but...
Poor old Jake slashing way outside off and...
I saw him get out. Yes, Then I left just after that.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about cricket, even though we love it.
I must admit, I love cricket. I'd love to be there right now if I could too. But there's lots of people there. It was really busy and it was good to see a lot of Territorians, a lot of interstaters there. Everyone just having fun, enjoying the cricket, enjoying the atmosphere. So it was a very good morning.
Fishing. The government has today announced this Barramundi Fishery Adjustment Committee. Come the end of September next year, Minister, what does success look like?
Success looks like when the licences have been brought back and that we can then continue to work on what does the Barramundi Fishery look like into the future moving forward. But right now we're just focusing with that Barramundi Fishery Adjustment Committee, working on a fair price and a fair formula to be able to ensure everyone can come out of this event reasonably happy. I accept that no one's going to come out, you know, pumping the fist saying I've had a win, but we want to act in the best interest of all Territorians here and make sure that we preserve that Barramundi fishing as we move forward.
In terms of the buyout of licences and the compensation for loss of assets, do you have a ballpark figure on how much this is going to cost taxpayers?
No, we don't. And that's what this committee has been set up to form, to work out what that ballpark figure would be. They're working now, and I know that there's some experts on that committee who have done it before and worked over in Queensland in relation to when they did something similar. So we want to make this this committee come back to us with a formula they're going to use, which we can then use to be able to work out what a fair price is for buying back these Barramundi licences.
We spoke earlier to Daniel Capps, who's the Chief Executive of the NT Seafood Council. He left us with this thought.
I think the penny is starting to drop with the public that, wow, there's actually going to be no World Cup Barramundi and Threadfin on the menu after September next year. And it's something that the government really need to address as a matter of urgency, I would suggest.
Are you addressing this as a matter of urgency?
Yes, we are. We've got a Barramundi Fishery Advisory Group, but like right now we're focusing on getting a fair price in relation to honouring our commitment, and we know the commitment is to phase out commercial gill netting in this term of government, and we're 2 years in, so we've got 2 years to do that. So we're working on that now, but we are also working with another committee to work out what can we do to have a wild caught Barramundi onto the table and some threadfin, what other methods are available, what's viable, what's not viable. But right now, we're 2 years in, we're focusing on getting a fair and just outcome in relation to the buyback of the Barramundi, and then we're going to continue to work on what does the future of the Barramundi fishing industry look like here in the Northern Territory without commercial gill nets.
Why can't you work that out right now?
Well, because it's a big thing, and we're working with people from Queensland because they've gone through this and before what they're using over there. The Queensland did a trial of what different types of fishing. So we're doing two things together here, Matt. We're not only working on what this fair outcome would be through the Barramundi Fishery Adjustment Committee, but we've also got the advisory group working out what can we do to keep some Barramundi, wild caught Barramundi, on the table in throughout the Northern Territory.
Come Christmas next year, do you think there'll be wild caught threadfin salmon available for sale?
Yeah. That'll be for the market to determine. We are working with the groups and with various organisations to make that happen. But, you know, we as a government certainly aren't going to be out catching that wild caught barra. But we want to work with these operators to be able to help them transition from using gill nets into other types of fishing to be able to put that those fish onto the table of the Northern Territory.
Another story on the Country Hour today, Minister, was a conversation with a company called Far Northern Resources. It and a bunch of companies are looking to strike it rich in the hills north of Pine Creek at the moment. Everyone's on the hunt for gold. And the director of that company made a pretty bold statement. Let's have a listen.
I think if the gold price holds up, which I expect it to, I think we could quite easily see four or five new mines open up within 250 kilometres of Darwin here along the Stuart Highway.
Four or five new mines opening up between Darwin and Pine Creek. Do you think all of the ducks are there to sort of make that happen for the NT?
Look, that's what we're aiming at. We got elected in 2 years ago with three pillars: to reduce crime, rebuild our economy and restore our lifestyle. And mining is part of the middle one about restoring our economy and making sure that we're ready to go. And we know that Primary Gold announced a new mine just yesterday. We know that there's things been going ahead in Tennant Creek with Tennant Gold about all sorts of new mining and new areas. We know Core Lithium are announcing some work done over there, and they're going to reopen that mine. History tells us there's a lot of gold around Pine Creek, and we certainly welcome those people to go in and do their exploration and explore and come back and lodge the environmental management plans to make sure that we keep everything right with the environment. But we encourage people to go out and invest, because that's going to lead to jobs, it's going to lead to more income into the Territory, it's going to lead to having more people live in the Northern Territory. So it's going to be a win-win for everyone, I think, in the Northern Territory. We can get those gold mines opening, and the government's job is to open the door and then walk away. Those other companies that you spoke about, their job is to walk through that door, manage all the regulations, environmental and mining licenses they need to be able to make an income for themselves, for the family, for the workers, and the supply chains of, you know, not just those companies, but there will be more work in relation to people supplying those mines. There'll be mechanics, hose fitters, welders, fitters, all those sorts of tradies will go in there and be able to have an opportunity to some of the businesses here, like in Darwin, will be able to expand because there's going to be more opportunity to, and that's another thing we've done, is raise that payroll tax threshold from 1.5 up to 2.5 to allow those smaller businesses to expand, to be able to employ more people, and apprentices, remember apprentices and trainees are exempt from that, to expand their business and give more Territorians jobs and have our economy grow.
Our text number at the Country Hour is 0487991057. Got a question from Lara, who wants to know, has the federal government's proposed legislation to make data centres be powered by renewable energy killed off your government's ambition to be the data centre capital of the globe?
Well, look, you know, the feds have got their right to do what they want to do, but what we want to do is promote industry in the Northern Territory. We know we've got the Beetaloo, and the Beetaloo can be the answer to Australia's gas crisis. It's clear evidence that there's going to be a gas shortage in the years to come. What we want to be able to do is promote the Beetaloo as an answer to that, so we can help power Australia. Of course, we want to power Territory first. We know our generators run on gas, so we're going to have that gas flowing into our generators September this year. And then once we get that up and running, we want to focus on industry around the Territory, which can rely, like these gold mines we spoke about. We're having gas to run their power stations and run their processing plants. And then we've got enough gas left over to be able to power the East Coast. So we really want to work forward. And if data centres is part of that, so be it. But we're not focused purely on data centres. We're focused on mining, agriculture, energy, defence. There's tourism, there's a whole range of things that we as a government are trying to promote to make the Territory a better place to work and invest.
if the Northern Territory goes against a national approach to data centres, does that risk companies going elsewhere?
Well, they're not going to be able to go anywhere in Australia because that's going to be a national policy right across Australia. And we, of course, can't stop companies investing in other countries, whether that be across the globe. But what we want to do is make the Northern Territory the most attractive place to be able to come and do business. We are working hard to reduce that crime, to make Darwin a place where people can come and can invest, to give investors certainty, because that's what they need. They're going to have an opportunity to invest right across the world.
Can I ask you, Minister, what do you think the social licence is like for these data centre companies at the moment?
Well, that's a manage that they need to do. They need to go out into the community and make sure the correct information's out there about what they use in relation to renewables and gas and water and where they are really going to be located. So we encourage those companies to go out and meet with the people in the community and talk about what they have to say. We're at this stage, all we've done is given Beetaloo Energy do not deal for 1 year on a block of land. Mm-hmm. The government aren't going to go away and build data centres. That's for private enterprise to do, and they have to manage that as well. But what we want to do is make sure the bigger picture here, that the Territory gets a benefit.
Thanks for your time on the Country Hour this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
No worries, mate. Thank you.
And we might see you at the cricket.
Maybe tomorrow or in the morning. See how it goes. If there's any more of a clats, it might be over. We don't know.
It's 4 for 106, so things are getting better.
They're going all right. We could probably settle down a bit. The ball's lost its shine, so maybe they can score a few runs now.
You're onto it. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
That is Minister Gerard Maley. Thank you for your questions this afternoon. And yes, the cricket, 4 for 106. Smith's on 26. Carey's up to 13.
Florals for spring? Never out of fashion. Organic Gardener magazine has your garden bursting with colour, abuzz with good bugs, and brimming with wicking beds and bunches of bananas. At newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
It's 21 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Tasmania has confirmed its first case of the deadly H5N1 strain of bird flu, a virus that has now impacted wildlife in every single state of Australia. It's now just the territories. It's the ACT and the Northern Territory, the only jurisdictions not to have cases of this virus. Tasmania's Primary Industries Minister, Gavin Pearce, briefed the media a moment ago. Let's have a listen.
The first case of H5 bird flu has been detected in Tasmania. A brown skua was called in by NRE Parks and Wildlife staff and collected by Biosecurity Tasmania from a place called Burgess Cove at Rocky Cape on the northwest coast of Tasmania. Following testing overnight, it has been confirmed that the skua has the H5 bird flu. While federal government is coordinating a natural response for H5 bird flu, I want to reassure Tasmanians that we are prepared to respond. What does that look like? To date, we have developed bird flu response plan, as well as a range of other planning documents to aid our response to our challenge. We've worked with the commercial poultry sector to assist them in development of biosecurity preparedness plans and ensuring that they are ready to activate those plans.
That is the Ag Minister for Tasmania, Gavin Pearce. Meanwhile, rare breed poultry producers in Tasmania are gearing up for one of the industry's biggest shows of the year. Mark Robertson breeds heritage birds on his property and says most breeders are nervous and worried about the arrival of this deadly strain of bird flu into Tassie, with judging at the Royal Hobart Show just weeks away.
Concerning, concerning from a wildlife point of view, concerning for people whose livelihoods are tied up with poultry and with other animals that can be infected. It's obviously going to be a big issue. How long it lasts for and what's ahead of us, there's a lot of uncertainty there at the moment.
The vaccine issue that was announced, what do you make of that?
What we should be doing is prioritising vaccines, and if those vaccinations are prioritised in the right areas, i.e. species and locations that are highly vulnerable, I think then that's probably a good thing. You've got birds that are highly rare and they are extremely vulnerable. But in the grand scheme of things, I guess I trust in the government's vision to actually prioritise the species that are most important.
How many birds have you got?
That's a question you never ask a chicken breeder. So at the moment I'd have between 300 and 400, I guess. So I've got a few, not as many as others, and it's obviously not a commercial concern, but it's a, you know, a lifelong passion, and there's a lot of money and blood, sweat and tears gone into, you know, keeping those birds, particularly breeding better birds, maintaining bloodlines, things like that. So
how do you protect them?
Well, this is the number one question. I guess what we've learnt from elsewhere is that exclusion and strong biosecurity are the most important things, but also things like identifying if your water source is a potential contaminant. So if you're capturing, so for me, I capture all of my water off the roofs of my poultry pens. Over the weekend, I'll be changing that. So the water will be coming from a safe source, from mains water or from, you know, chlorinated water source, so that I know that that's safe and virus free. And that potentially eliminates one point of concern. So that, I think that's really important that people understand, you know, where the virus can come from, because as I understand it from other places in the world, like the US, that has been a primary source of contamination for dairy farms or for, you know, for chickens. That's one point that's important. And the other thing is limiting contact between wild birds and my birds. So if I can control those two things, then that gives me a fighting chance to try and keep my birds safe. When no one's going to be 100%, but it does give us a fighting chance.
What are other poultry fanciers saying at the moment?
I think there's a fair bit of nervousness there. There's obviously, you know, misinformation out there. There's naysayers, which are counterproductive to, you know, having good outcomes, I guess, for everyone. The general consensus is concern, and it's concern that reaches beyond your own backyard. It's concern for the hobby. What would happen if for the next 4 years we don't have poultry shows? You know, that I'm probably one of the younger poultry exhibitors getting around. What happens to that older generation who've been exhibiting their whole life, have a break, do they come back? We've seen things like that happen with COVID. And so, I mean, there's real concern there for the hobby, for the actual shows and biosecurity, and how the future of showing poultry or animals, noting that this disease isn't just limited to poultry, how that continues into the future. We'll enjoy the last throes of being able to exhibit poultry and enjoy our birds.
And that means the Royal Hobart show will go ahead, the poultry show?
At this stage, the Royal Hobart poultry show will go ahead. It's in 2 weeks' time on the 27th. It's actually really exciting for the committee and for RAST. As you would know, the showground's been undergoing a major redevelopment, and this is the first time we'll have poultry back at the showgrounds since that redevelopment. RAST have committed heavily to poultry, which is great. So we've got 1,000 shiny new pens. So we're really excited to get back to the new developed showground.
Will the public be able to attend?
Public at this stage are able to attend. You know, and we will be certainly making sure that biosecurity is at the front of everyone's minds, but the public will be able to attend. We don't know what will happen to shows, but we're hoping this will be a good last hurrah for a period of time, potentially. Maybe not. Maybe we'll be back next year at the same time. Hopefully. We just don't know what's going to happen.
And with the number of birds you do have, people are saying, you know, what do you do with them? Do you sell them off to other breeders, or do you have 300 to 400 at a time all the time?
Oh, well, I would keep stock birds and then breed during breeding season, which we're starting breeding now, build up numbers and then sell them to other exhibitors or the general public as well. I've got a long-standing commitment to rare breeds and to, you know, heritage breeds of chicken, which is what the basis of exhibition poultry is. One of the main driving reasons that I got in the first place is that I believe the next generation should have access to those birds, should be able to feel the enjoyment that I've got out of those birds over a period of time. And I think that's really important.
Now, vaccination, is there a possibility that some of your birds can be protected?
It's not something that I've explored at this stage. I don't think it has been used heavily internationally. And from what I understand, where it has been used, it's had limited efficacy. So, look, it remains something that may come in the future. As it stands, I don't vaccinate any of my birds for the existing diseases that we've got. So I've been one to breed for resistance rather than to rely on vaccination.
That's Tasmanian poultry breeder Mark Robinson speaking to Tony Briscoe about bird flu, which is now in Tasmania, and the Royal Hobart Show is just around the corner. Meanwhile, the Melbourne Royal Show has made the call. It's decided it will not hold poultry exhibitions or competitions in 2026 because of the spread of this H5 bird flu. And the Royal Adelaide Show, it has also cancelled bird competitions ahead of next month's event due to bird flu concerns. More information up on the ABC Rural website this afternoon. Australia are 4 for 122. Things are getting better there at Morara Stadium. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Darwin and keep it rural.